A reading from the Gospel of Mark. Then he began teaching them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, Jesus rebuked Peter and said,
"Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things."
He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them,
"If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life?"
This is the gospel of grace.
On my birthday, this past November, I wrote this in my journal. "God, I have asked you to show me how to die to myself. I am not there yet. Will I ever be?" The question mark at the end of that sentence in my journal was glaring at me, causing me to feel frustrated that I haven't perfected this desire to give my life to Jesus. This idea of dying to myself is something that has always been a bit hard for me to grasp. I remember growing up in church and learning about taking up my cross and following Jesus. As a child, I remember thinking this must mean that God had something terrifying for me to do, such as move to a far-off country and be a missionary. Little did I know, all these years later, God would have something much more terrifying for me to do: preach a sermon at Broadway Baptist Church. In our scripture passage today, it is clear what is required of us to be a follower of Jesus: deny yourself, take up your cross, be willing to lose your life for the sake of Christ. I've been wrestling with this feeling for months that I don't know how to give my whole self to God. I want to be a follower of Jesus. The desire is there, but I often seem to fall short of it. I recently met with a mentor of mine, and we talked about this. She asked me to think of an image or a metaphor that would help me sort of get my mind around it better. I said with haste, "Well, it's sort of like jumping off of a cliff." She quickly sensed that this might not be very helpful for me and said, "How about you think of a different one?" I gazed out the window of her office and looked at the trees. I thought about the trees I had seen on my way there. It was mid-November when the leaves had changed color, and they literally took my breath away. Their colors were a brilliant red, orange, and yellow. Some of them even looked like they were glowing. And I thought to myself, as I looked out of her window, "They are dying. Those leaves, they are dying. And yet, it was so beautiful." As I began to think about this image, I wondered, why does the tree have to let its leaves die? So I did a little research. I learned that during the cold winter months, a tree loses its leaves to protect itself and conserve energy. The cold, dry winds can strip moisture from the trees through the leaves. By losing its leaves, a tree can keep moisture in the trunk and the branches rather than drying out and dying. Also, when the leaves fall to the ground, they provide a layer of protective mulch to insulate the roots. Under the ground, the roots are being protected and preserved so that the tree can conserve its energy for a new growing season. On the outside, it looks as if the tree is dying, but underneath, in the soil, it is still very much alive. It's in the process of becoming, and sometimes this process feels like death, but it's actually leading to life. And with each year, the tree grows a little taller, a little stronger, and its branches reach a little farther out into the sky. But it must be willing to let its leaves die, to let go, to trust its creator that the dying is a part of the process. In our scripture passage today, we see that Peter was also in a process of becoming. In this part of his story, Peter is distraught by what Jesus is saying. He hears the words suffering, rejection, and death, and it's as if he can't hear anymore. While planning this service, we talked with the 5th and 6th graders about this passage, and the part they found most interesting was the fact that Peter rebukes Jesus, and that Jesus calls Peter Satan. It is a dramatic scene. Peter, the follower, takes Jesus, the teacher, aside, and I wonder what he said. Another translation says he scolded him and corrected him. No, Jesus, you must have this all wrong. And Jesus, in front of the disciples, sternly corrected Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not thinking God's thoughts, but human thoughts." But Peter was a human, after all. Can't we humans understand where Peter was coming from? In the passage just before this one, the disciples were asked by Jesus, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter, always the one to speak up, proclaimed, "You are the Messiah." Full of faith, Peter. And why wouldn't he be? Jesus, up to this point, had been very busy healing the sick and disabled, telling life-changing parables, feeding thousands with a few bits of food, and walking on water. This was the type of Messiah Peter and the others were looking for, and they were ready to get on board. Until these words: suffering, rejection, death. It was a turning point. There was suddenly more to being his disciple than watching him heal and hearing him teach. The stakes were rising, and it was getting serious. And Peter spoke out of fear. I imagine the other disciples were thinking the same thing, but leave it to Peter to say it out loud. Maybe Peter was speaking for us, too. Do we quietly try to correct Jesus when things get too hard or life doesn't turn out the way we had it planned? How do we react when the stakes start to rise? Well, this wasn't Peter's first mistake, nor would it be his last. Peter walked on water, and his doubts made him sink. Peter spoke too soon on the Mount of Transfiguration and was basically missing the point. In the Gospel of John, it says that when Jesus was arrested, it was Peter who drew his sword to strike the high priest's slave, but Jesus corrected Peter as if to say, "Do you still not get it?" And it was Peter who, after swearing he would never deny Jesus, said that he didn't even know him. Not once, but three times, out of fear of saving his own life. However, this speak too soon Peter, this rash and raucous Peter, this not so perfect Peter, this getting it wrong Peter, was the one Jesus called the rock. And he went on to preach boldly the message of Christ and opened the door of the church, not only to the Jews, but also to the Samaritans and the Gentiles. When Peter made a mistake, Jesus kept forgiving him, teaching him, and bringing him along on the journey. Jesus kept using these hard lessons to make room in Peter for an ever-growing capacity to be a true disciple. But I wonder what things had to die in Peter along the way. What leaves had to fall to the ground to allow for growth? Maybe pride, fear, definitely his own plans of how he thought things needed to go. But he never let his failures take him off of the path with Jesus, and Jesus never let him go. And because of that, he came to know Jesus as the true, full picture of the Messiah. It's comforting for me to reflect on Peter's story. If Peter was in a state of becoming, can I be as well? Is it okay that we don't always, under every circumstance, seem to have gotten this following Jesus thing right? Like Peter, we are on a journey. When we fail, Jesus forgives us, teaches us, and brings us along on the journey. But we also have to ask that question, what needs to die in me? What do I need to let go of to continue on the path toward new life? A big one for me is fear. Fear of failure. Fear that something bad will happen to someone I love. Fear of the judgment of others. But it's a beautiful thing when we start to name our fears and watch them fall into the hands of the only one who can sustain us no matter what happens. What do you need to let fall into the loving hands of God? As I was preparing for today, I kept thinking about these Club 56ers. That's what we call our fifth and sixth graders who have planned and are leading our worship service today. They are at a turning point. We can all remember what middle school was like. The stakes are rising, and it's starting to get a bit more serious. Childhood, with its carefreeness and its developmentally appropriate self-centeredness, is beginning to be a thing in their past as they gaze far up the road toward adulthood. They're beginning to have to figure out who are they going to be and who are they going to follow. They are realizing that following Jesus will cost them something, and trusting in God's plan can be scary. Will they continue to follow him? When a girl is faced with a choice of standing up for someone who is being mistreated, even though it means that she will also be mistreated, what will she do? When a boy sees the expensive array of possessions that promise happiness and acceptance, will he hear the still small voice that promises true fulfillment? They are starting to ask, is it the approval of others or living in the center of God's love that brings me true life? And they, like Peter, will fall and fail and hopefully return every time to the loving arms of God, all the while growing a little taller, a little stronger, and their branches reaching a little farther out into the sky. And as adults, we know this journey continues. We keep learning these same lessons as well. We give our life to Jesus one day at a time, one season at a time. Sometimes all we can do is give one leaf at a time. But we stay on the path, and we keep returning to the one who gave everything for us to know abundant life. And that is, in fact, the promise: abundant life now. While losing our life can cost us a lot, we are actually saving it. Writer Elton Trueblood says that the basic paradox of freedom in our Christian life is this: we are most free when we are bound to Christ. Peter seemed to miss this point in today's story. He only heard the words of death, but he missed the good news, the part where Jesus said, "And after 3 days, I will rise again." But we know the rest of the story. Death leads to life. The bare tree that has lost all of its leaves in the winter sprouts beautiful blossoms in the warm spring sun. For with every part of our journey, the successes and the failures, the joys and the sadness, our branches grow farther out, reaching toward our God. And those branches, when they sway and move in the wind, they look as if they are dancing. Maybe we too can dance with God. But we still might have this nagging question of how. I want to know, how do I give my life to Jesus? James Finley wrote a book about the author and Trappist monk Thomas Merton. He quotes Merton, who said, "How does an apple ripen? It just sits in the sun." Finley goes on to say, "A small green apple cannot ripen in one night by tightening all of its muscles, squinting its eyes and tightening its jaw, in order to find itself the next morning miraculously large, red, ripe, and juicy beside its small green counterparts. Like the birth of a baby or the opening of a rose, the birth of the true self takes place in God's time. We must wait for God. We must be awake. We must trust in God's hidden action within us." So that question mark at the end of my sentence in my journal, it doesn't have to glare at me anymore. If you have a similar question mark, it doesn't have to glare at you either. That question mark can be a symbol of our process of becoming, a symbol of growth and adventure of what lies ahead on this journey. And the good news is, we can put our anxiety aside because it's not up to us. We don't have to tighten our muscles, squint our eyes, or tighten our jaw. We can release our grip and rest in God's hands. We stay on the path and trust God's hidden action within us. Really, we just have to sit in the sun.